Excuse me, may I talk to you for a second?
Yes. This is the Black Real Estate Dialogue. And the purpose of the Black Real Estate Dialogue is to document the journey of an up-and-coming real estate investor and to share the stories of successful Black real estate investors.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Black Real Estate Dialogue podcast, episode 153. A few quick announcements before we jump in. Take a moment to subscribe to the show if you haven't already. Also, please take a moment to leave a 5-star rating and review. It helps us out a whole lot. And so I look forward to hearing from you. It also takes you less than 30 seconds. So definitely looking forward to hearing from you. And if you do leave a 5-star rating and review, send me a screenshot at info@blackrealestatedialogue.com. And in return, I'll send you a free training on finding and analyzing properties. All right. So excited about this episode. This episode is actually from a live event that I recently did in LA. It features Nick Goucher, who is the co-founder of Legacy Home Loans, the largest Black-led mortgage company in the country. We had him on the show previously to talk about their new mortgage product, which is specifically for Black borrowers. So definitely make sure you go back to that episode and check it out. And also it features Crystal Denman, who was previously on the show a couple of years ago. And she is a flipper here in LA. And so really, really good episode. We spoke about gentrification. We spoke about creatively investing in expensive markets, different financing strategies people can use, and so much more. There's also Q&A from the audience. So you'll be able to hear some of the questions that were asked, and hopefully this can help you on your real estate journey. All right. So without further ado, let's get into it.
Thank you all so much. So I'm Sam Dalcini, the host of the Black Real Estate Dialogue podcast. I see a lot of familiar faces, some new faces. Appreciate you all so much for being here. I started this podcast 3 years ago in a 250 square foot apartment in Inglewood. And the reason I started is because I wanted to share the voices and the stories of people who look like me, who I could relate to, because I wanted to start investing. And so I'm like, you know what? Let me find some awesome people to interview and to share their stories. And I got to shout out my man, Josh, right here. Wave at us, Josh. So I was on his couch. He just moved into his apartment. And I'm like, man, what if I started a podcast about Black real estate investors? We didn't have a long conversation. He said, do it. And so, you know, any design you see, any logo you see, the merch, like he designed it. So shout out to Josh. Appreciate you, Josh. Let's give him a hand. So been doing it for about 3 or so years. I think this past week was episode 148. We've had some awesome guests who you'll be able to talk to and learn more from today. So all our panelists today have been on the show. So we're going to talk to them, catch up with them, see what they have going on. We'll also have Q&A at the end of every panel as well, so you can get your questions answered. So really appreciate you guys. Shout out to my wife behind the merch table. Let's give her a hand. All right. You ready to get started? All right. So we're going to get started with our first panel. We have Nick Goucher and Crystal Denman. Let's give them a hand as they come up. How y'all doing?
We're good.
Great.
Good. So to start off, can you both introduce yourself, let people know who you are, what you do? Crystal, let's start with you.
Sure. Thank you. My name is Crystal Denman. I am known as SoCal Flip Gal on Instagram, and I am full-time in real estate doing house flipping and wholesaling in the LA, specifically South LA area, and I've been doing it full-time since about 2014.
Hey guys, my name is Nick Goucher. I'm the co-founder of Legacy Home Loans. It's the largest Black-owned mortgage bank in the country, licensed in 44 states, 57 employees, and we're blessed in the last 3 years, well, last four, 2019, we've helped 3,300 Black families become homeowners. We've lended at this point close to $745 million worth of capital, so.
Love it. So it's no secret, we live in one of the most expensive markets in the country. And so Crystal, you mentioned that you've been flipping for about 8 years now. Nick, I know you also invest too. How did y'all do it? How were you able to tap into this expensive market and have success? Nick, let's start with you.
So my personal story, my personal journey, is that what you're asking about? So I purchased my first home in 2013, bought a property in Inglewood. It's interesting because right before we did it, you guys now know that's like the Rams stadium happening now. But before that, That land is owned by the Walmart family, and the Walmart family happens to be married to Stephen Kroenke, who's the owner of the Rams. And so when they were going to go away with Hollywood Park, they were going to build a Walmart in that land, like the biggest Walmart. Who wants a Walmart in their nobody? Because it's like a community stiller, right, of like other small businesses. And so luckily at that time, the city council, the homeowners in Inglewood decided to vote against the measure. And that's what allowed us to bring in the stadium now. And so I was privy to that in 2013. And so I bought a property. And then I bought that property for $383,000 in 2013. And that property increased to $660,000. And so I was still working and a top producer in the mortgage business. And so we bought a second property in that community. And that property, we bought it for $660,000. It increased to $790,000. Then we bought a property in Compton, a property in Carson, a property in Palm Springs. So truly, we just leveraged as we went, right? So one property, initial investment $35,000, and you know, within 10 years, it's now a $3.9 million portfolio. And so we just started small, but we took our time. We were patient. We weren't in a rush with it. And then over time, we just kept pouring money. So we kept our expenses low, really important. Even though our income increased, our debts did not increase. So we essentially had a lot more cash flow to put money back into our what we call a wealth creation account. So every time we had more money in that account, we just bought more property. And that's how we built it.
What about you, Crystal?
So a little bit about my journey. When I first got started in 2014, I was just fired from my job. And really kind of real estate for me was supposed to be plan B. So I was supposed to be a pediatrician. That obviously didn't work out. And I was just sort of like going to real estate meetups like this just to sort of like learn the game, because I figured, oh, I'd be this rich pediatrician, this rich doctor. I need to learn how to invest my money. But plan B ended up turning into plan A. And because I just got fired from my job, I didn't have a lot of capital, but I had a lot of time. So I started out mainly wholesaling just to sort of like build that capital, wholesaling just in the areas, in the markets that I felt comfortable with, because I felt like I knew those areas. I felt like I could build my network, people that I could trust and stuff like that. So wholesaled a couple of deals, and then I didn't have a wealth account, but I saved that money that I got from wholesaling and just sort of like transitioned into fix and flip. So starting off with some, you know, smaller projects, you know, just sort of cosmetic rehabs. And then the most recent project I did like practically everything. New construction, master suite, new construction, ADU, pretty much foundation to the roof. The whole house was new. So that was kind of like my journey in wholesaling and house flipping.
Love it. And Nick, you talked about leverage. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because as people are considering investing in LA, cost is a big thing that people are thinking about. So what are some ways people can leverage properties they already have in order to buy more, and just other ways people can finance if they want to purchase investment properties in LA?
So a question for the group. How many of you today are currently homeowners? By show of hands, own homes, okay. How many of you want to own homes? And how many of you want to be able to say invest? Okay, so the whole group. You got a good audience, I like it. So leverage. That's an interesting question, and it's also unique too, because sometimes you can over leverage as well. And so I think that everybody should have like a blueprint in terms of who they are. And I'll tell you that usually when I look at my strategies are 10-year strategies. I'm not trying to really build wealth tomorrow, because real estate is a long-term game. 90% of millionaires since 1800 have built their wealth. 90% of millionaires in this country are through real estate. Real estate is not a quick flip game, even though the bubble in 05 to 08 was the only time that ever happened before. And usually when you see rates like how they are now, it means debts go up higher because payments are more affordable. And so I would say you should have a blueprint first. If I would go back to anybody, I would say, so give you guys some context, okay? Write this down. If you guys can, take some notes really quick so you understand the power of real estate first, all right? So the average person today who has a stock portfolio, their average stock portfolio has $40,000 in it. The average person has total bank deposits, $41,000. The average 401k today, $119,000. The average equity in real estate for each American today is $330,000. Three times 401k. Real estate outperforms all those assets combined. You can Google this, it's facts. It's not Instagram, this is like facts, okay? And so I would tell anybody who wants to get in the game, first thing is, before you decide to do anything, make sure you can take care of home first. So I would say have 6 months of savings put aside first, because a recession is when you have two quarters or 6 months of bad performing markets. So if you can survive a recession, then you're good, right? So 6 months first of savings. Why is it important? More context, because going back to 2008, 50% of Black Americans, or 50% of the foreclosures happened to Black Americans because they were over-leveraged, right? Many of them were given what they call ghetto loans, which is a Wells Fargo term that they use. They were sued by the city of Baltimore about this. And so you don't want to just get into a house without being prepared for it. That's the first thing. So 6 months first. Once you have that put aside, now if you have a personal issue, you're not pulling personal funds for business, because real estate is in fact a business, treated as such. And so I think once you have that, the next thing that I would say for you to consider is that then what I did was we did build a secondary account called a wealth creation account. That was the actual name. And every time we had additional money, we just put it aside of this other account so I can be ready for the next opportunity. So before you go to leverage, know the business, know your market. So after you have that secondary account, then start studying the market. And also think about, what's your timeline? Are you looking to build wealth in a year? If so, you might as well buy Bitcoin. And then you see what happened to that, right? There is no fast-paced game of building real wealth. It's sustainable over time. So think of real estate as a 7-year, 10-year play. You would give yourself time. So if the market goes like this, you're still fine because you're playing a 10-year game. Does that make sense? Before you even do the leverage. Now, once you have the leverage, Brother Sam's case, we had a property that we did leverage. It was a property in Compton that had a tremendous equity in the property. But when you leverage, what that means is you're basically going to refinance to take more debt on that property. So you got to make sure you can still service the debt. Really important, right? So for example, maybe at that time, my payment might have been, let's say, $1,700. But once I leveraged, which I did because I bought a property in Carson to do it, I took a $200,000. And the payment went from $1,700 to like $2,700. So what I had to do was I had to increase the rents on the tenant so I can offset the expense so it didn't pass through me. But what if I could not increase the rents? Now that becomes the difference between what my tenant's paying and what I'm paying comes out of my pocket, right? So you can over leverage. So you got to make sure when you run the numbers, you say, okay, pull up an Excel sheet. Okay, if I owe this, I'll take out $100,000 to buy the property in Carson. My payment goes up here $1,000. Okay. My tenant, they're paying $27, but I'm behind. I can increase it 8%, so I can go to almost $3,000, somewhere in that ballpark. That covers the debt, right? So it leverages. Now, when I buy the next property, how's that property going to perform? If I buy the asset, why am I buying the asset? If it's a rental property, will the rents by the tenant cover? And even if they can't cover, do I have money put aside to cover what they can't? So I have tenants in Compton and in Carson, and at that time during COVID, some of them, you know, had lost their jobs, and so I had to be able to cover what they couldn't. And so I think leverage, to that point, we should be more educated around smart leverage and not over leverage, because you have people who can tell you what they used to do, not what they're doing, right? You can go through a fast cycle of, hey, I made a bunch of money in Bitcoin, now you have nothing. Or you over leverage the asset that you can't afford, so the bank took it back. Right, so wealth is a slow, long-term game. And if you guys could understand that and then do smart leverage, you can build wealth.
I thought you were gonna tell me I could build wealth in 2 weeks. Just kidding. Crystal, we don't live in a city with $100,000 homes. And so how are you funding these flips? Because you're thinking about the acquisition cost, the cost to rehab, and all these holding costs, all these things. So what are some ways you're financing your flips?
Sure. So I usually finance my flips through primarily two methods, hard money loans and using private lenders to fill sort of that gap. And what I mean by the gap is lenders are not going to lend you 100% of the financing, especially if you're a first-time flipper. So at most, they're usually lending you maybe like 90% of the purchase and maybe 90% of the rehab or 90% of the purchase and 100% of the rehab, where you are then responsible for that 10% difference as well as any carrying costs. And another cost that I think a lot of flippers sort of forget to include is what I like to call that gas money, right? So even though the lender will give you, you know, 190% of the rehab, it works in terms of the draw. They're expecting you to do the work and then they'll reimburse you. So you're going to need to have money to fill that gap of that 10%, service the loan for however long you have to keep the project, as well as that sort of gas money to get the rehab started. So usually the private money lender will close that gap for me, and that's how I'm able to finance these projects. And I think a lot of times when we're in, you know, our market, we see these big numbers, you know, houses $500,000, $1 million, and it's still, then the roof is falling off. But I try not to let that buy number scare me, and look at it more in terms of what is the number that I need to for that gap. And that's usually about, like, on the smaller end, maybe like $75,000. If you're doing a larger rehab, it's maybe like, you know, more towards six figures. When you start to think about it like that, to me, it becomes a much more manageable number. It's less scary. Because we're looking at, you know, $100,000 in Detroit, St. Louis, or whatever, we're fine. Well, here, don't look at it as $500,000, $700,000. Just look at it, what do I need to bring to the table? And so I think when I try to change my mindset and sort of look at it like that, it became less scary to me, and I felt more comfortable doing it.
Got it. Can you explain how you find hard money lenders and just what that is in case somebody may not know?
Sure. So a hard money lender, so we have our traditional big box banks like your Wells Fargo's, JP Morgan Chase, and stuff like that. So hard money, huh? Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm just teasing. Go ahead. I'm just teasing. Go ahead.
We also have Legacy, which is black owned.
Check that box.
We check that box for her right there. But hard money lenders, contrary to, you know, your conventional lenders, they care more about the asset versus your personal finance. So when you're trying to qualify for like a home or something like that, they care more about you, the borrower. What are your W-2s? How much money do you have saved in the bank? What is your FICO score? Whereas a hard money lender, they care less about you and more about the asset. And they are willing to, you know, lend on property that may not necessarily qualify for conventional financing. So normally your banks are going to want it to be somewhat livable condition, and sometimes some of these properties that we're purchasing as flippers, they're not going to qualify, so you're going to have to use hard money. So they're a little less stringent on their criteria as you as the borrower, less stringent on their criteria as you as the house itself, and it typically funds a lot quicker compared to traditional financing.
Got it. And you also mentioned private money. I have a problem asking somebody for $5, and you're talking about $75,000. So a couple of questions. How are you finding these private money lenders, and what's that conversation like to try to get these funds?
You know, it can be a tricky conversation, especially I feel like within our minority communities, talking about money isn't as easy of a conversation as it is for, you know, outside communities. But you'll be surprised, like, you know, Uncle Ray Ray at the barbecue who got the dingy t-shirt probably has, you know, $50,000 saved up and you don't really know it. So I think just sort of like having those conversations, talking about real estate everybody is interested in real estate in some point because of how it's been popularized by the different TV shows and stuff like that. And I think everybody starts to want to like dip their toe in the water per se. And a lot of people aren't necessarily wanting to deal with tenants. Not everybody is interested in being a landlord. Not everybody is interested in dealing with contractors. So this is a way when you talk to people like, hey, you know, if you have some money, here's a way to get into real estate without having to do it, what I like to call the top five tenant toilets, trash, termites, and turnover. And you could get a consistent return that is not subject to the ups and downs of the stock market. It's secured by real estate. It's truly passive. You know, you're not dealing with people and stuff like that. And it becomes a easier conversation. People are, you know, kind of, it piques their interest. So that kind of is a way to sort of like, and once you kind of like show them like, hey, these are my plans. This is how much I plan to buy it. This is how much I plan to rehab it for. This is my profit even after I pay you. People are usually kind of like open to sort of, you know, having a conversation. So.
Love it, love it. And we also are in a competitive market. We all know that. My wife and I, we saw a property near where we live. It was a 4-unit building. And we just inquired. We're like, you know, we'll check it out. We'll go inside. We'll see it. We spoke to an agent. Within like 24 hours, there are 14 offers. They're not showing the property anymore. They're, you know, negotiating with different people, countering, whatever. What are some ways people can get their offers accepted? I guess, Crystal, for your standpoint, to get into like flipping, and then Nick, from your standpoint, either to have it as an investment or as a primary residence. And Nick, we could start with you.
I don't know, for me, I get most of my deals off market. So I usually talk directly to sellers. I don't do a lot of on-market purchases simply because I don't like that person in the middle. I just like kind of directly communicating with the person. And with that, I'm sort of able to see what they really want in terms of not only price. Some people, there's other things that are important to people that, you know, obviously people want price, but some people, there's other things that are important to them in how you structure the offer. So you could try to meet them with their price, but also maybe they need to find another place. And I might put in my offer, all right, I'll release, you know, 20 grand from escrow so that you could use that money to go find you another place. So I think really for me, when I'm trying to find, you know, property off market, not communicating with the seller beyond the price and seeing what they really want out the deal to make my offer stand out to them because that's what they want.
Yeah. One, he gave the example of Leimert Park. You're going to realize places like Inglewood, Leimert, Baldwin Hills, View Park, you have to understand what you're priced against because you have people who live in Westchester and in Culver City who might sell their home for, I mean, a property today in Westchester, right? A two-bedroom, two-bath might be $1.9 million. But that same property in View Park is 1.7 with a view of the whole entire city. They sell the property, they're going to bring $1 million to buy the asset when you're a first-time home buyer wanting to go FHA, right? Or they might have all cash. And so there are some markets that are hotter than others, but real estate, by and large, is a local game. And so if you look at it across the country, I mean, like I think it was in September, Zillow's reported that like 27% of all listings dropped their price, right? And so there are some, one of the properties that I actually sold, I had to drop my price because I had the property initially, for example, I was going to put it on the market in December when rates were like 3.5%. And it was, that property was $675. I said, I'm going to, you know, hold it. And then the market went up. I said, I think I'm going to sell it. But when I decided to put it back on the market in June, rates were now 6. So that person who was going to buy the property, they can buy it at 675 because a payment at 4% is much more affordable than a payment at 6.5%. Does that make sense? And so some markets are more competitive than others. But by and large, I would say if you are going to sweeten the deal, trying to get the offer accepted, what we're seeing across the country, this works, and also in LA as well, is one, if you increase the down payment, if possible. The seller thinks that the thought is if you have more capital put down, you are better risk or you're a better chance of closing on that property because you got more money for a down payment. Number one. Number two, we're seeing people who might change their loan program. So if you qualify for FHA, there's sometimes misconceptions that FHA means you're a less qualified person because they will let you go and buy with a lower credit score. But if you went, let's say, conventional, they look at that as a more qualified buyer. So the seller's thinking to themselves, if I have these people over here, right, are you 14 of you, and you guys all give me your file, and whoever has the highest credit score and the highest down payment, I think is most likely to give me the money to close on the actual home. And so those things can happen. I think number two, even companies like Legacy Home Loans and mortgage companies, they're coming up with new programs like 2-1 buy downs, 3-2-1 buy downs, where you can basically, if the rate today, let's say 7%, you can possibly walk into that house with a 5% interest rate or a rate of 4%. And then every year it goes up by 1% till it goes back to the market rate. What it does is it basically increases what you can offer to buy the property. So if you buy the property and you know it's at a 4% rate initially and your thought is, well, rates might come down, well, be careful with that. Even though they should, they probably will, but don't make that bet that it will. We were here before 12 years ago, right? So that helps you increase your buying power. You can shorten your contingency period. So let's say if most people write a contract for 30 days, some banks like Legacy can do it in 14 days. It's all about the likelihood of that seller getting their money. And so if you do some of those strategies, even us, there are some banks who might look at the asset and might be willing to offer cash for you. So you can basically buy the property in 7 days and then you finance a mortgage after you have the actual asset. So there's new strategies that exist to do it. But I think the biggest thing to take away from is that there are some markets that are still very competitive because people want housing in areas like Leimert and Inglewood and Baldwin and View Park. Those are great markets to be in now, but the competition, if you draw a circle around it, you get a lot of West Side people coming to that market because it feels like it's a safer community right now. So those things, I think, could help.
Love, and last question before we get into Q&A. I know you two are both LA natives. I've only been here a little over 6 years, and so I don't know the full context of the gentrification that's taking place. You know, I've seen a lot of changes since I've been here, but what's your take on the gentrification that has been going on, and you know, what are your opinions, Crystal? We could start with you.
You want me to go first? That's a tough question, and it's hard for me to give my opinion without sounding like Candace Owens.
You could be. It's a safe space. You could be honest with us.
Keep it rolling. We'll meet you by your car on the way out. I don't know, man. This is a tough question for me. Part of it, I feel like it's just, I think what we're seeing is, I think a lot of times in the past, we've been able to sort of like income and race have been pretty much aligned in the past. And I feel like now with like, you know, the economy and everything else, that's starting to sort of separate. And I think, you know, people are priced out of every neighborhood. So people who wanted to live in Redondo, Manhattan, had to come to Westchester. People who wanted to live in Westchester had to come, you know, Culver, whatever. People wanted to live in Culver had to go to View Park, Leimert, and stuff like that, and it just keeps moving eastward, so to speak. So, I don't know. I think it's more of we're just seeing that economics and race are no longer sort of like aligned and sort of coincide with each other. That's sort of like my personal opinion. And I mean, we've been, sometimes we don't necessarily stay in our neighborhoods. Like a lot of people who had ownership in those neighborhoods decided to go to Lancaster, Corona, Apple Valley, Moreno Valley, Atlanta, Houston. Now y'all mad. I don't know what to tell you. Like, and I mean, it's like we want development in our communities and then we get it and then you cry gentrification. We're like, I don't know what you want. I'm just glad I'm Black, because if I was white, I would be like, I don't understand what y'all want. that's just my very personal, unpopular opinion of the whole G word. That's probably not what you were looking for, but that's...
No, I wasn't looking for a particular... Like, we're here for all opinions. I wasn't looking for a particular answer. I'm actually glad you were honest with your opinion. No, I mean, give your honest opinion. That's what we're here for. Nick.
That was great. Nick. Clap it up for that.
Hey, Nick, we don't need polish, so you can say how you want to say it.
Fair enough. Gentrification, it's a French word. It's been around since the 18th century, and it tends to go in lines. It started back in France. It's essentially a word when a community is revitalized. That's what it means. I think the real question is what the word means to us. That's really the question. Because on one side, you're a long-term tenant in a property and you might have been saving, and all of a sudden you see a neighbor who was not a neighbor before, who's now a neighbor, and that drives a price point. But truly, when I see gentrification, I benefit from it because I'm a homeowner, right? And so I really think what happens is it's how does it benefit you? So if you're a renter and you've been renting in that community and you never owned, and now the landlord wants to spike your price up, right? Now that impacts you. So now you want to join the local tenant, and you want to picket against the idea, but truly, if you remove yourself from the word and just think about what's happening in these communities, you look at Inglewood is a good example of this, because in 2013, 14, so context, my father lives in Inglewood. He lives off 89th in Van Nuys. My brother went to Inglewood High School. I got into my first fights in Inglewood at St. Andrew's Park in 7th, 8th grade. I had to run home after, so I could jump a couple times. I didn't run, though. I just took the L. how we built. And so I remember a time when Inglewood wasn't as desirable. And then a mayor comes into the city, Danny Tabor, who's my frat brother. He was a mayor of the city, and he had some plans, and the mayor Butts decided to come into the city, and he wanted to be pro-business. So he wanted to lower the taxes for businesses to come in, because if businesses come in, they're going to increase city revenues and city taxes go up, and now you can create better roads. You can create better schools, crime lowers. And now when they see momentum happening in cities, new money comes in. And people who might not have been a neighbor of yours says, you know what? I'm living here, but I can live 3 miles closer to where it's happening, more dense. It's a good situation. And home values go up because demand increases. And so really, I think I would challenge just the thought of people and really think about what does the word mean to you. Because on one side, even to that point, like if you are a homeowner, right, you're still impacted by it, because if home values go up, taxes go up, right? And if you can't afford the taxes, you could lose a house too. And so it is a real impact. And so some of the things that we've been doing in transparency is, so we've been doing these things across the country. We started doing this in Charlotte. So to give you some context on this really quick, there was an MOU that we signed like 18 months ago. There was this software company who had like this app, and the app basically would kind of like match people who wanted to get married, like an eHarmony kind of app. And then a few years ago, he started a new app where he wanted to start off in Charlotte to look at renters and do like disc profiles on them to see if they're suitable to live together. Because what's happening in this country, people are getting married less. So a lot of one income households take place. And so if you're a single income household person, your affordability is impacted versus the couple or the two people who have two incomes together, buying power increases. Make sense? And so I think one of the things that we can do is we can still be change agents of our community if we say, you know what, let's find strategy. Well, now let's say if you're a tenant in Inglewood and you're in Inglewood, and let's say you guys are really good friends, instead of complaining about it, join the coalition and also take advantage of what the growth. Because if you could afford the property, and if you see that your asset goes up and your wealth goes up, you benefit from it, you would change your view on what that word means to you. And so I would just say more strategy, more long-term thought around it, I think would help people kind of change what that word means.
Love it. And before
what
we,
he oh. said.
And before we shift into Q&A, where can people keep up with you? Where can people follow you, get in contact with you, work with you, all that good stuff?
Sure. So on Instagram, I am SoCal, FlipGal, SoCal, like Southern California, FlipGal. Email info at SoCalFlipGal.com.
You guys have your phones? Hold on. Do we have 2 minutes? I need 30 seconds. Can I see your phones? Please, come on. Please, come on. Please, help me out. Help your brother out. Go to Instagram, please. Please. Go to Legacy Home Loans. Legacy Home Loans, please, if you guys don't mind. You guys see us? You guys do a quick, let me see what it would, you know, his head nodded, which means he follows me. Let me check to see if he follows me or not. Hold on 1 second. Hold on, let me see. Okay, I got one new follower. Hello? Oh my gosh, that's why I like you, man. I like this. I love it. So yeah, team, if you guys can follow us on, you can follow me at Legacy Home Loans. It's a phenomenal crusade that we're on, and a lot of it thanks to my brother Sam. To give you guys some context, Legacy went viral back in September because we were the first mortgage company to come up with a program exclusively for African American people, and it was called Closing the Gap. No. So can I break it down for a second? So in 1974, there was a when fair housing law passed in 68, the ECOA law passed afterwards. And under ECOA, there was a law called SPCP, Special Purpose Credit Program. It was a law protected under ECOA, under Reg B, that allows lenders or financial institutions to create product designed for individuals who have been discarded historically. But we never had the backing from government for protection from the law. So even if a lender does it, like a Legacy Home Loans, we're a mortgage bank, but we depend on capital markets to buy the mortgages. Because let's say if I give you a loan, right, for $1 million, we can't wait 30 years to get that money back. So we need a capital partner who's going to buy these loans from us, and they call the secondary market, so we can stay liquid to do more loans. So we needed to have a partner to do this, and so we found one. And that was through, I won't even say the actual name, because it was a white label, but long and short. So we created the actual product, and then it was a rival to B of A's, if you will. The difference was, at that time, B of A were letting you purchase in black and brown markets. We wanted you to be black, okay? Because that was who was most discarded historically through redlining and white flight across the country. And so I did a podcast, and then somebody told Brother Sam about it. And then me and Sam did a podcast, I think, back in September, October. So he helped us kind of go viral a little bit. So clap it up for my brother Sam, if you can, pretty please. So I appreciate that. And so I'll just tell you guys that Legacy Home Loans, we are an inclusive lender. And we work with all kind of groups. But we exist because my CEO of the company, his name is Ben Slayton. And Ben is 80 years old. And Ben was the first black realtor in America in 1964. And Ben has been a 55-year mortgage banker, and he has bought and sold companies many times. He's a millionaire many times over. And about 4 years ago, he had found a young, hungry, passionate, successful mortgage banker and said, I want you to partner with me because we have a problem. He said, that problem is, in 2017, there was a report called The Road to Zero Wealth. You can Google this right now if you guys want. It was a think tank organization that looked at the wealth in this country and said that at the rate that black people are being boxed out of the game, by 2053, the average black family will have negative to zero wealth.
Mic drop, whatever, right?
And so essentially the question becomes, you can complain about that figure, or you can do what our ancestors have done in the past, and you can pick yourself up. You can walk towards justice. You can walk towards mobilization. So we mobilize a movement across the country with our allies across the board who want a good product, who want a good service, competitive interest rate, but who knows that that money goes back into our community and we are going to close a wealth gap together. That's why we exist.
Clap it up.
So we have time for some questions. If anyone wants to ask a question, you can come up. I'll hand you the mic. Don't all jump at once. But if you have any questions, there's no dumb question. If you can come up and grab the mic. Yeah. We need that audio. You're good. Or any one of the mics.
I'm a relatively new realtor. And my question is, over the last year, I was actually looking in Leimert Park for a commercial building for a church. As I was looking, I can't tell you, probably 10, 15 buildings, all vacant, nothing's going on. Some of them were churches, some of them were just regular buildings, just no activity. So I kept, and I reached out. So I had to do a whole lot of digging, because you know what it takes to find out who actually owns it. Number one, sometimes it's really hard to find. But two, even when I found some people's homes, delivered a letter to them, they never responded. But what I noticed is that all of those people were white. All of these buildings were in Leimert Park. Why do all these white people own buildings that are not using them? And they're just leaving them there. How does that work for them? Because it certainly isn't working for us, because it's just leaving empty buildings in our neighborhood. So I'm not understanding for them yet why that makes sense, because I'm new to all of this. So that's my question.
Benicia, come up here. You have an answer for that? What do you think? So, I mean, look, we're just speculation, right? Because that's a question. I would say that, so a couple things. Remember, Leimert wasn't always a black community, okay? So some of this land has been with people for many, many years. And so if they own the land, remember, the asset is still in their family. So let's keep that in mind. So even though the property could be vacant, that land still have an asset value on it. I think that's number one. I think number two, I think the biggest thing, this is more about capital markets, or, you know, because you said that you reached out to people, but they were all white for the most part. I think that business, by and large, is based on trust and familiarity. And so if, for example, you are somebody who they don't know, you're not in their circle, you're not proven to them, then sometimes they'd rather hold it and wait for the right opportunity or the right buy than to sell it at what they think could be a discount. And so I think we have to think about a couple of things. One is, again, even though the land, because I'll give you an example on this, actually, I had a client named a Dr. Diaz. He was an Armenian guy, and we opened to buy some property. And you guys see where the Clippers are building that all the whole land? So he owned this small plot of land. It was like right by Church's Chicken. You guys know, right, where it's at Prairie and Century, Church's Chicken. And he was holding, and I was like, he said, hey, you know, you want to, I said, how much would you sell that property? He was like, I wouldn't sell that land right now. I was like, why? He's like, because I know they're going to build something on it. And when they build on that land, they're going to have to offer him a premium to take the actual land and ownership. And so I think, one, the way you see it is not how they see it, number one. And I think that number two, many times it's about getting in the circle of capital injection, because sometimes Alicia's, I know that she's really big in like kind of capital deployment through syndication. But if she doesn't have the trust, if they don't know her, no relationship. So most capital is based on relationship. And we don't have that many times. I think that's probably the reason why you didn't get some, you know, response backs.
Any other questions?
So my question for you is about leverage. I know that you said you kind of scaled over time. With leverage, of course, I know a lot of lenders look at the debt-to-income ratio. How did you, especially in California, in the market, you know, it's probably at the top, other than New York probably tops it. How did you manage to do that? Did it come from building a relationship with a lending officer, or your income just growing and able to support that debt-to-income ratio based on your assets?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I was when I was in the business as a mortgage banker, I was the top 1% mortgage banker in the country for 4 years. So I made a great deal of money before I came to Legacy Home Loans. So when I ended up doing it, it was easy because my income was enough to carry all my debts. But I think by and large, to give you an example, to leverage, there is a program that we actually use too called a DSR program, right? It's called a debt servicing. It's a debt servicing loan program where, matter of fact, we have access to this too at Legacy Home Loans, where if you own a property, let's say you want to take, let's say, cash out, if the payment, right, that is going to be after you take the cash out, your payment is $3,000 a month, right? If the rents on that property services the debt, that's how they'll qualify you. So we won't even use income, just your credit score. So usually if you have a credit score over 660 or 680, and if you have usually loan to value 80% or below. So let's do an example. Let's say that you have a property, $400,000, that you owe on it. And let's say it's worth $800,000. And let's say that you want to take $200,000 out of that property. So you want to borrow six to pay what you owe plus the cash. You know, work the numbers, the payment, taxes, insurance, mortgage payment. Let's say it's, you know, $3,000 a month, right? Then we'll look at, this is usually for multifamily properties, by the way, usually, because we need to see the actual income. So then what we'll do is we'll order an appraisal. And as long as the rents that we can forecast on those doors can meet the mortgage payment, that's how we'll qualify you. And so to, you know, her point, she mentioned how like doing wholesale or doing hard money loans, they look at, can the debt service itself many times, where your income and credit don't really matter, more so does the asset perform and can it carry its debt? And so those programs do exist.
Yeah. Good question.
Anyone else?
Mentioning that in the DSCR loans, I use those for my LLCs. Do you all offer that for personal and businesses, or is it mainly just people doing it within their own names and financing debt within their own name, I should say?
Yes, good question. So that loan program is under what you call non-qualified mortgages, non-QM loans. And those non-QM loans, you can buy those assets under personal or LLC. You can. But if you're coming to a mortgage bank, like a conventional loan, you know, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, to buy 1 of 4 units, it's on the personal individual. And so it's your income and your credit. But on that program, it could be both LLC and personal. That's a great question.
All right. So we'll take a 15-minute break before we get to our next panel.
Was this good? Clap it up.
Yeah. Clap it up, clap it up.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast. Remember to follow us on Instagram at Black Real Estate Dialogue and on Twitter at Bread Podcast. That's B-R-E-D Podcast. Until next time.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. At ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only.
Prices and participation may vary, while supplies last. Tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.